now just 15 days away from the midterm elections, and we're asking you, how hard or easy has it been for you to cast your ballot?
There were no lines. It was pretty empty in there. Seemed smoothly run. I went in and vote and headed on home.
Fortunately, mine was the shorter line. The other line was wrapped around the block and then again.
I used to live in Oregon where we did vote by mail. It was super easy and fun to vote. Now that I've moved to Minnesota, I'm kind of anxious about what's going to happen when I go to vote, because I've never had to stand in a line and go into a booth.
The polling place was walking distance from my house. It was more work to purchase groceries.
A lot of voters came in misinformed about the voting process and assumed that, quote, something must be rigged or wrong.
I am disabled, which makes getting into the voting place sometimes a little bit difficult. By federal law, each polling place is supposed to be accessible, to which I say, horse hockey. My voting place has never been accessible.
And voting doesn't just vary according to who you are and where you live. It can also differ based on the type of ballot you cast on election day.
Our voting machine was a touchscreen machine.
The ballot was a paper ballot that was then scanned. However, the scanner didn't work, so I had to drop the ballot in a bin for a manual count.
I've submitted absentee ballots because I'm a Navy wife.
Massachusetts has paper ballots and are scanned, not touchscreen, which leaves a paper trail.
My state is always easy, where all voting is by mail.
So with such a fragmented system, how can we keep our voting process secure and, most importantly, fair? This week, we'll take a look at how our election system works, where it's broken, and what we can do to fix it. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. There are more than 10,000 election jurisdictions in this country. That's right, I said 10,000. And within those jurisdictions are hundreds of thousands of polling places. And in a presidential election year, you'll need about a million poll workers to make sure things run smoothly. That's a huge amount of infrastructure to protect from the kinds of threats we've learned about after the 2016 election, like the potential for foreign interference and hacking, and other gaps in the system like outdated machines and unequal access to polling places. David Becker is here to discuss this splintered system of ours, and he's the director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, great to have you on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So a lot of what we're thinking about here and a lot of what we heard from our listeners is that we really don't all vote in the same way. Why do we have so many different types of voting in the United States?
Well, that's right. There's actually about 10,000 little elections that are held on each election day rather than one big one. And that really dates back to the founding of the Republic, where in the Constitution and in our traditions, it is typical that the states have control over elections, and within the states often delegate that responsibility down to the county or sometimes even the municipal level.
So we talked about this thing that I know people go, oh gosh, infrastructure. But when we talk about election infrastructure, we're talking about a couple things, right? There are a list of names, there are counting systems, there are reporting systems. Can you help us understand these different categories?
Sure. There are various administrative and technological processes that go into running elections, as you can imagine. And elections uses technology just like any other government or private sector area. And when we talk about elections infrastructure, we're talking about an entire ecosystem of technology that we need. I usually simplify it down to three basic areas. First, maintaining the voter lists themselves. In every state other than North Dakota, voter lists are maintained. And those voter records need to be maintained in a database and be accessible not just to the state election authorities, but also to the local election authorities so that they can update that information. And then that information needs to be transferred, sometimes in an electronic poll book, which can look like a laptop, that goes to the polling place to allow poll workers to check voters in on election day. So that's the first main area of technology that's used in elections. The second is all the technology that comes around casting and counting the ballots. So about 80% of people in the United States can cast ballots on paper. Those paper ballots are often fed into large tabulators that might look like large copy machines, for instance, that feed these documents in and read all of the ballot markings on them so that they can count them. Some people still vote on touchscreen machines, and there's technology inside of those that allows those ballots to be counted as well. So that's the second big area of technology. And then the last area of technology is once the polls close on Election Day, everyone pretty much expects election results to be delivered out immediately. And as a courtesy, election administrators try to get those results out, unofficial though they may be, as quickly as they can to voters and to the media. And that system, that election night results system, is another area of technology that's used in the entire elections process.
I'm talking about election infrastructure with David Becker, and that's basically everything from how you register to how you cast your ballot to how it gets counted. David, we hear a lot about the voter rolls, and you talked about maintenance of those lists. Who is in charge of maintaining these lists? Because we're hearing a lot about people, including here in New York City, where some voters got letters saying that they were taken off lists or they weren't eligible to vote. How does that happen? Why is there so much confusion at that stage?
Well, the state usually takes responsibility, although the counties play a very large role in that. And one of the real challenges is, and I've done research in this for many, many years, is that Americans are highly mobile. They move between elections, and election officials don't get very good information on that. And I think most election officials would agree we want all of the eligible people to vote and be on the lists. But we also want to make sure that if someone has moved out of New York, for instance, or moved out of your state, that they can be easily removed from the list. And there are federal laws that govern that as well. So getting really good information on when someone has moved or when someone has died and making sure you get it right can be very, very challenging. And there are, as I said, federal laws that govern this. And there is additionally a tool that election officials can use in some states. New York doesn't, but 24 other states do. It's called the Electronic Registration Information Center, or ERIC for short, and I led the effort to create that. And it allows election officials to get much better information, much higher quality information on when a voter might have moved out of their state or within their state or died since the last election.
You know, I'm wondering also, David, why don't we have a system that, and I know we've heard about this, a lot of folks will talk about this, but why don't, isn't there a system where folks are automatically registered to vote when they turn 18?
So there are, what we lack in the United States and what many other countries have is some kind of official registry of citizens. We don't have one magic list in the United States where all citizens are on there with up-to-date information at any given point in time. So often the best database in a state of who might be eligible to vote is the motor vehicles database, but that's incomplete. Sometimes it's not up to date, but it is the best one. And many states have been moving towards taking the information that citizens provide them at motor vehicles and automatically transferring that information into the voter list. And that can be a very, very effective tool to not only get new voters onto the list, but even more importantly, keeping those that are already on the list with up-to-date information so election officials know how to contact them.
Yeah, in 2017, just before leaving office, the former Department of Homeland Security Secretary Johnson designated this election infrastructure as critical infrastructure. And I'm wondering, if this infrastructure is so critical, why does it seem to be broken in some areas?
So I don't know that I'd say it's broken. I actually think that we're in better shape than we've ever been.
And why do you say that, David? Because I think then that's a competing narrative to often what we see in the news.
Well, there are a lot of folks in the news who are portraying a narrative that things are more vulnerable than ever and that nobody's doing anything about it. And I can tell you, having worked on this issue for a long time, there's been more work done to secure the election infrastructure in the last 2 years than we've ever seen before. And the 2018 election will be more secure than any election we've ever held. Even though there are real threats from foreign adversaries, election officials are now sharing information better than ever before, not just between the states, but also down to the county level and all the way up to the federal government on potential threats. There are more tools in place to monitor potential interference in election offices than ever before. Nearly 90%, actually over 90% of all voters live in jurisdictions that now have highly sophisticated sensors monitoring activity coming in and out of the system. This was not where we were in 2016, and it reflects the tremendous improvements that have been made by election officials. It's not as sexy a story to talk about the hard work that election officials and DHS, the Department of Homeland Security, is doing to try to secure our systems, but it's the real story that voters should know that when they go to vote in November of 2018, that their votes are going to be counted as they cast them.
Well, how do we know? I mean, I'm less interested in if it's a sexy story as opposed to if it's one that's true here, because we are continuing to hear this, and we're seeing long lines in Georgia, for example, this idea, you know, the letters that have been sent out to New York voters. And those things, I think, tell us that, or at least give the impression to Americans that their vote is, you know, may or may not be counted, or they may run into some difficulties at the polls, particularly if we're talking about poor people and communities of color, David.
So I'd make several points about that. First of all, the letters that go out about voter list maintenance and about the possibility that you might have moved are required under federal law. And the reason that they send those letters out is to tell people we might be removing you from the list. But even if you get a letter like that, you're not being removed from the list for another two federal election cycles. You go into an active status. And that means if you show up at the polls to vote, you will be given a regular ballot and your voter registration will be activated again so that you won't fall into an active status again. In the case of long lines in places like Georgia, we have to remember this is early voting. These are people who are opting to vote in an area where they've afforded them the opportunity to vote early, which is really good. More voters have the opportunity to vote early than ever before in the United States. And so if the lines are long, come back another time. It's much better than finding a long line in a place like New York where you can effectively only vote on Election Day. Most places allow for early voting now.
How much is the voter infrastructure or the election infrastructure really insulated from the politics of who's in office, right? Is it something that's at risk of being politicized? I ask that question because of what we're seeing right now playing out in Georgia with Kemp, for example, who's got one foot in both of the sides here.
So there are instances where things are not working out as they should be, and Georgia could be one of those places. But I'd also point out it is not unusual for secretaries of state to be on the ballot when they're also running the election. That nearly 20 states have that going on right now. And in most of those states, there's no problem with it at all. The candidate can separate the campaign from the secretary of state running the election, and that's something we're seeing whether they're Republicans or Democrats. So I think what we're seeing in places like Georgia are outliers compared to what most voters are experiencing, which is the easiest process that they've ever had before.
David Becker is the executive director and founder of the Center for Election Innovation and Research. David, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Five top Saudi Arabian officials were fired and 18 others were arrested over the weekend following the kingdom's acknowledgement that Jamal Khashoggi was killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. According to the Saudi investigation, Khashoggi was killed after a confrontation in the consulate. Turkish officials dispute this account and leaks to the press, saying the attack was targeted. Amid the Saudis' questionable explanation of Khashoggi's death, a new report from the New York Times reveals how the Saudi government uses troll farms to orchestrate digital attacks against dissidents and journalists, including Khashoggi. Ben Hubbard is the Beirut bureau chief for the New York Times, and he's been reporting on these social media campaigns.
Troll farms are basically, you know, the best way to picture them would be like a call center, like you would have, you know, to field public relations requests or customer requests, something like that, except this would be a group of people who have been hired to be very, very active on social media to promote some kind of agenda. In the case of the story that we wrote, this was obviously to sort of do a number of things to try to benefit the relationship or the reputation of Saudi Arabia. So this is to attack content that appeared to be negative to Saudi Arabia and to promote content that is positive for Saudi Arabia.
And tell us who was behind the troll farm and whether that farm can be traced all the way back to the highest levels of the Saudi government.
Well, it would be pretty impossible for something like this to happen without the knowledge of the Saudi government. I mean, this is a monarchy. It's an authoritarian state. So it'd be very unlikely that, impossible for this to happen unless it was signed off on, you know, by the government. And we know that one of the officials who was in charge of this effort is somebody who's very close to Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who is, you know, the de facto ruler of the kingdom.
And what are some of the messages that these trolls were using?
There are various ways that they do this. Sometimes it's just to try to manipulate hashtags that are already out there. So if there's a hashtag that they perceive to be negative to the kingdom, they can sometimes just flood it with various kinds of spam so that it becomes, in a way, unreadable. They also try to game the algorithms that Twitter has to try to get certain hashtags onto the trending topics. So if there's a hashtag that picks up or that some cases may have actually been created by them, they can drive a tremendous amount of traffic to that. and, you know, try to get it on the trending topics list, which makes it much more likely than anybody inside of Saudi Arabia who's on Twitter is going to see that particular topic. You know, to take a step back, you kind of have to understand how important something like Twitter is in a country like Saudi Arabia. Again, this is an authoritarian place that doesn't have really free media. I mean, almost all of the newspapers are government-owned. There's not a lot of public engagement or civil society. There are not really places where you can go and discuss. And so when Twitter started spreading in Saudi Arabia, probably 7 or 8 years ago, it was, you know, it was a huge deal for the kingdom. And a lot of people then were very optimistic and said, oh, this is going to be this great new technology that's going to lead to, you know, it's going to democratize the discourse. What we've seen is that, you know, this government really had the ability to manipulate all of that because they have huge, huge resources from the oil wealth. They were able to buy really the best off-the-shelf technology that you can find. And they just, you know, they're very organized. So they can, you know, either create automated bots or, in the cases that we wrote about, hire human bots who, you know, or trolls they're called, or sock puppets. There's various terms that people in tech use for this. But basically hiring people whose job it is to weigh in on these social media debates and try to shape the way that they go. They've drowned out a lot of messages. They've amplified other messages. They've managed to get certain things that would not have been trending on the trending lists on Twitter. So they've ended up being very effective. And they end up playing a role. Social media plays a very large role in these countries in just shaping people's perceptions of reality, just as media does in any country. But the difference in Saudi Arabia is that there are just fewer avenues out there. And so when they can so effectively manipulate what people are seeing when they get on Twitter, they can really have an effect on how people really perceive the world around them and perceive their own government.
Well, you also reported on an ex-Twitter employee who was spying on behalf of the Saudi government. What do we know about that person?
Well, we know that there was a Saudi engineer, a Saudi tech person who got hired by Twitter, was working there, and then Twitter was basically tipped off by American law enforcement and said, we have suspicions about this person that he has been, whether he was working directly for Saudi intelligence or whether he'd been sort of recruited to do this bit of work for them is not entirely clear, but the concerns were great enough that he was using his access to the company and his access inside of Twitter to basically look up information about certain dissidents and provide that information to the Saudi government.
I'm wondering if we're paying attention to this more now because of Jamal Khashoggi's death. He was, in fact, one of the folks who was targeted by these campaigns, was he not?
He was definitely targeted by these people. You know, there was, you know, Jamal, by the time he was killed, had, last time I checked, I think it was somewhere around 1.5 million or more than 1.5 million followers on Twitter. He was very prolific on Twitter. He would tweet in Arabic. He would tweet in English. He would interact with people. He would post articles. And, you know, so for someone like him, this is a very powerful publishing platform. I mean, there are, you know, lots of articles published by the New York Times that don't get 1.5 million views. But, you know, somebody like Jamal had that many followers just on his own Twitter account. So they put a lot of effort into trying to fight back against him. And so he would get lots and lots of comments and lots of abuse and things like that. So, yeah, he was definitely sort of one of the people on their list that they were, you know, trying to influence the way that the content he was putting out was being received by people.
Oh, we should also be clear that Twitter as a company has been under fire for a while now for what it allows and doesn't allow on its platform and how it controls what people can say and what they can't say. And I'm wondering, from your reporting, have they said anything about all this? Have folks from Twitter responded to either the employee who was supposedly working on behalf of the Saudis or to how their platform is being used in this instance?
I'm not aware of any direct response from Twitter to the article that we published on Sunday. I mean, I know that they certainly have talked about other ways that they've tried to do this. There was, you know, they put out information a few days ago talking about a large sort of bot network, I think they called it, that they had taken down, that was sort of a pro-Saudi bot network that Twitter had taken down. So, you know, they are certainly aware of the problem. And, you know, when Twitter executives speak about this, they say, you know, well, we want to do everything that we can to allow the medium to function. We don't want to be censoring people. We don't want to be taking things down unless otherwise necessary. So, I mean, I think for Twitter, they're trying to find the balance between keeping the medium as open as possible, but then also stepping in when they need to try to shut down things that are nefarious.
Ben Hubbard is the Beirut Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Ben, thanks so much for your reporting on this.
Thank you.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Babbel. People around the world are learning new languages with the Babbel Language Learning app. Learn Spanish, French, Italian, German, Russian, Swedish, and more with Babbel's 10 to 15 minute lessons. You'll learn through interactive dialogues, speech recognition, and fun trainers and quizzes. And in a few short weeks, you can be speaking a new language with confidence. And Babbel is available as an app or online. And right now, you can try Babbel for free. Go to Babbel.com and download the app and try it for free. That's right, Babbel, B-A-B-B-L-E.com, or download the app to try it for free. Babbel.com.
Hi, everyone. It's Tanzina Vega with you on The Takeaway. A few weeks before the Republicans passed the tax bill last December, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell made his pitch.
The fact of the matter is, the average family of four would get about $2,200 a year in tax relief, and that's pretty darn important.
Well, now a new report from the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy and Prosperity Now, two national nonprofits, raises doubt about the idea that the tax cuts are broadly enjoyed by all Americans. Joining us now is Jeremy Greer, Prosperity Now's Vice President of Policy and Research. Jeremy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Tanzina.
So who's benefiting from this tax bill and who isn't, based on the research that you all have done?
Yeah, so what we have here is a situation where you have a tax bill that appears to be a race-neutral tax bill, right? It focuses on income. Actually, the IRS doesn't even collect racial data. But what happens is when you implement a tax bill in a race-conscious society, some of the same biases that you see are baked into that tax bill. Overall, who benefits are very wealthy white people. So 43% of all the benefits that come through this tax code are captured by white people in the top 5% of income earners.
And why? So some people might say, well, what about wealthy black Americans, or what about wealthy people of color?
Well, wealthy people of color do pretty good, but they still don't do as well as very wealthy white people. So, for example, wealthy blacks through this tax code make about $20,000 per year, where wealthy whites make almost $52,000 per year through this tax code. So even very wealthy blacks and Hispanics and Asians do far worse than wealthy whites in this tax code.
And let's talk about tax cuts. I mean, you guys had some data here that showed that, again, the wealthiest household, white households, receive more in tax cuts than black and Latino households. What is that about?
So our tax code largely rewards wealth that is already created. So people that put money in investments and are able to get their income through capital gains, people that are able to pass through income through corporations, similar to what was highlighted in New York Times is the way Donald Trump's father handled a lot of his tax liabilities. People that are able to do that do a lot better in this tax code. People that earn income through wages are taxed at a higher rate than people that are able to earn their income through investments. So even on the high end, LeBron James, for example, he earns his money largely through income from the Los Angeles Lakers, and that would be taxed at a 37% rate, where Warren Buffett makes a lot of his money through investments, and that's taxed at a much lower rate of 20%. So what you see here is a situation where there's bias in how you earn your income. And people of color tend to earn their income through wages, therefore are taxed at a higher rate.
How much does this have to do? I mean, we know, I guess, one of the underlying factors here is the racial wealth gap in this country. And without getting too in the weeds there, basically, can you tell us how that's impacting what we're seeing here? Is that some of the baked-in systemic issues that you're talking about?
Yeah, essentially what we have, and you've covered it quite a bit on your show, is we have a racial wealth gap that is expanding year by year, decade by decade, century by century, and has been going on and is largely the product of public policy. You know, it starts with land seizures from American Indians to African Americans being seen as property, not even people, and on into housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and then currently all that manifests into how benefits are distributed through the tax code. So what you have is a tax code that is supercharging the racial wealth divide by exacerbating those inequalities by driving benefits that come from the federal government to the very rich and aren't going down to the very poor.
And let's talk about the very poor. What does the report reveal about the poorest taxpayers?
It reveals that they're getting very little to nothing from this new tax bill. So African-Americans, very low-income African-Americans, get about $90 over the course of the year for this tax bill in benefits, where wealthy whites get about, as I said, $52,000 per year. What that equates to is about 25 cents a day that African-Americans get through this tax bill, while wealthy whites get about $143 a day through this tax bill. And you see that whether you're low income, black, white, Asian, Hispanic, you don't do very well here.
Jeremy Greer is the Vice President of Policy and Research for Prosperity Now. Thanks for talking to us, Jeremy.
Thanks a lot, Tenzin.
Voters in Afghanistan went to the polls on Saturday, casting their ballots in a parliamentary election that had been delayed for 3 years. More than 2,500 candidates were in the running for just 250 seats. And the run-up to the election was extremely tense and deadly. Threats from the Taliban throughout the country heightened the danger of participating in these elections. At least 10 candidates, as well as dozens of their supporters, were killed in the months leading up to Saturday's vote. But the day of the election also saw heightened levels of violence. Although the exact number is unclear, targeted attacks led to more than 36 people dead on Saturday alone. Sikandar Kamani was reporting in Afghanistan over the weekend. He's a correspondent for the BBC based in Islamabad, Pakistan.
Well, there were dozens upon dozens of violent incidents over the past 2 days in Afghanistan, including a suicide bombing in the north of the capital, Kabul, in which 15 people were killed. In that incident, we understand a suicide bomber was trying to get inside a polling station when police stopped him from doing that. At that moment, he blew himself up, killing people who were around him. But having said that, for all the tragic loss of life that there was, by Afghan standards, this wasn't a particularly bad set of days. Many people had feared that there would be a lot more major attacks. I mean, I've been reporting from Afghanistan for the last year and a half, and some of the attacks that we've seen in the last few months, for example, have seen 50 people being killed in one single attack. And we didn't see anything like that. So from a security perspective, certainly there were people who were killed. There were attacks. People were, in some cases, prevented from voting. We already knew going into these elections that a third of all polling stations across the country were going to have to remain closed because of security concerns. But these elections were more peaceful than many feared they would be.
Are they considered democratic by the electorate because of the attacks and the threats and many of the problems we just outlined?
Well, in Afghanistan, a lot of people are quite disillusioned with politics after years of violence and of corruption. Actually, though, being in Afghanistan over the last week or so, there were a lot of people who were also quite optimistic at times because they felt that in these elections, unlike in previous elections, a number of the candidates were young, were from professional backgrounds, were well-educated, and people felt that they were in a position to offer Afghans some real political change and move away from a kind of system of politics that's dominated by ethnic factionalism and by old warlords. Having said that, there has been a lot of criticism within Afghanistan of delays that occurred during the election process. A number of polling stations didn't open on Saturday or opened late, so voting had to be extended into Sunday. While I was at some of the polling stations, people would come and tell me that despite having registered, they couldn't find their names on the voter lists. There were also problems with a new biometric voter verification system that was introduced a little bit at the last minute, really. It's designed to prevent people voting more than once, but because it was introduced so late, a lot of the staff, it seems, weren't particularly well trained in how to use it, and that helped contribute to the delay. So there has been a lot of criticism of the organization of these elections.
You mentioned a lot of the younger, more educated candidates that are running. I'm wondering, are there any themes, are there any common political threads that they share, you know, something that might be resonating with this electorate?
Well, one thing to note is that in Afghanistan, one Parliament isn't particularly powerful in comparison to the position of the president. The second is that the political parties aren't really dominant in the parliament. Most candidates stand as independents, even if they are affiliated to political parties, because political parties in the country are often associated with factionalism and struggles for power. So a lot of the people who stand, as I say, are independents. And that means that they can cultivate their own constituencies of support, really. So certainly we saw a lot of people who were former journalists, civil society activists, standing, and these were some of the people who voters were quite enthusiastic about. Alongside them, though, there were also a lot of big businessmen. There were the children of former so-called warlords who were standing for the first time as well. So quite a mixed bag of candidates who were standing, and a huge number. I mean, over 2,500 candidates standing across the country. In Kabul alone, where I was, there were 800 candidates for 33 seats. So the ballot paper was about 15 pages long. It's kind of looked like a newspaper, really.
And there were about 400 women who ran among those candidates. What can you tell us about them?
Exactly. So that's not actually that different a number from the number of women who ran in the last set of parliamentary elections. In 2010, there were also around 400 women who took part in those. But as I say, there were a number of women amongst these candidates who people are more enthusiastic about. I was speaking to one female candidate. She was just 26 years old, very well-known TV reporter in Afghanistan. And she was saying to me that she was standing because she viewed the older politicians as basically being corrupt and acting like a mafia, in her words. And she wanted Afghanistan to move away from them, as well as the fact that there were 400 women, 400 old women standing. I think around 60% of the candidates were under the age of 40.
And what about the current president, Sukhinder Ashraf Ghani? He's been president for over 4 years now. Does he still have support?
Yes, he certainly does. And in fact, one of the reasons why these elections are seen as so crucial is because next April we'll have presidential elections, and they'll be much more politically significant because, as I say, the Afghan political system is quite centralized. So the president really is the key to the country. And so these parliamentary elections were meant to have taken place around 3 years ago, and they've been delayed ever since, and only just happened now. So these elections were seen as a kind of dry run, if you like, for those presidential elections. People wanted to see, would enough Afghans feel safe coming out to vote? Will the results be accepted? That's another crucial question, because previous elections have been marred by allegations of fraud, and many fear the same could happen again. So these are all key concerns that the people have about the next year's presidential elections, and we're hoping to get some kind of indication from these elections about how it will go.
Sukhinder Kermani is a Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent for the BBC. Sukhinder, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We finish today's hour with a look at a law designed to protect women from domestic violence, a law that's now in limbo. President Bill Clinton first signed the Violence Against Women Act in 1994, and it was meant to tackle domestic violence, rape, sexual assault, and stalking.
The Violence Against Women Act combines tough new sanctions against abusers with assistance to police, to prosecutors, and to shelters in the fight against domestic violence.
The original version was the first time that the federal government had said domestic violence is a criminal justice problem that requires a criminal justice solution.
That's Lee Goodmark, the director of the Gender Violence Clinic at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law, and an attorney who for decades has represented victims of domestic violence.
So in 1984, several things happened that started us down that path. One was the Attorney General's Task Force on Family Violence, which for the first time started looking at domestic violence as a criminal problem. One was a fairly major lawsuit in which the police's failure to intervene in a domestic violence case resulted in a substantial judgment to a woman who'd been gravely injured when the police failed to protect her. And looking at all of that data, anti-violence advocates really started to advocate for a federal solution that put serious money behind this idea that the criminal system was a way to address intimate partner violence.
The act has since been authorized three more times, and not always easily.
In 2013, the reauthorization was a little bit rocky around issues of Native American women and undocumented women and extending anti-discrimination provisions to the lesbian, gay, transgender, bisexual plus population. And now it's up for reauthorization again.
But its fate is uncertain. As the latest version is debated in Congress, Lee says it's time to talk about the ways she believes this law has failed victims by emphasizing criminalization and what could be done to make it work better.
My argument is really that we've now had about a 25-year experiment with criminalization, and it hasn't appreciably lowered rates of domestic violence. In fact, while all other kinds of crimes have fallen, between 2000 and 2010, the rates of domestic violence fell less than any other kind of crime. And that's at a time when we were putting hundreds of millions of dollars into the criminal legal response to domestic violence. To me, that seems like good money going after bad, and it's proof that what we're doing isn't really working. And so in my book, what I advocate for is looking at intimate partner violence as an economic problem, as a community problem, as a public health problem, and as a human rights problem, primarily, with the criminal system there as a backup in those cases where intervention is absolutely necessary.
I do want to point out that for some women, the Violence Against Women Act has actually saved their lives, and I think it does become a criminal act at a certain point.
I wouldn't disagree with that, and I don't take away from any survivor's experience with the police. For some people, intervention by law enforcement is absolutely necessary, but that's partly true because we haven't offered people anything else, and we haven't thought about the things that cause intimate partner violence, so we haven't really addressed any of those things. I've been a lawyer representing victims of violence for the last 25 years, so I've been in court day in and day out looking at how the legal system intervenes into people's lives. For some people, that intervention has been absolutely essential. For others, it's been a total nightmare. The intervention of the criminal legal system has meant that they've had their children removed from their care, or that their partners have been arrested and convicted against their wishes. In some cases, it's meant that my clients have been arrested and charged with intimate partner violence as a function of the mandatory arrest laws that were part of the 1994 Violence Against Women Act. I've talked to hundreds, if not thousands, of women about the operation of the legal system in their lives, and that's what's led me to believe that we need options beyond the legal system.
So let's talk about some of the alternatives to this level of reliance, at least on the criminal justice system. I mean, what would a balance between criminalization and prevention actually look like, according to you? How do you see that breaking out?
You know, one is looking at intimate partner violence as an economic problem is absolutely essential. It has unbelievable economic facets. It costs our economy billions of dollars. Putting economic wealth into the hands of people who've been subjected to abuse is absolutely essential to give people the ability to leave violent relationships. But the research also shows that under and unemployed men particularly are more likely to commit acts of intimate partner violence, which suggests to me that if we were attacking the issue of under and unemployment among men, we might actually be doing something to eradicate intimate partner violence as well. If we think about public health, one of the things that correlates very highly with intimate partner violence is exposure to adverse childhood experiences. And so thinking about how we avoid child abuse and neglect, how we intervene to make families healthier and safer, how we eliminate intimate partner violence in the homes of small children so that they're not having these adverse childhood experiences could also have a significant impact. What that means is investing in parenting programs and nurse home visitation programs and interventions with men who use violence that are effective. You know, one of the problems that we have is that the research base on batterer intervention programs isn't great, but there are programs that are really making a change. Instead of by using shame, by using men's desire to be better parents, we're looking at the intersection of substance abuse and intimate partner violence, or actually dealing with men's trauma. So PTSD and the perpetration of intimate partner violence are very highly correlated. If we look at the trauma that people have experienced, not as an excuse for what they're doing, but as a way of understanding what they're doing and a way of trying to help them change behavior, we could actually make a tremendous impact.
Let's talk about where the legislation stands today. It's still waiting to be reauthorized. We're in a very polarized moment in this country. Is there a bipartisan effort to reauthorize this? And if so, what would that look like?
There isn't strong bipartisan effort to reauthorize, though McConnell has said that it will come back up, and I don't doubt that. One of the things that the advocates did this reauthorization was to be modest in their goals, knowing kind of what the political scene looks like and how unlikely it was to be able to push through major changes. And looking back at the 2013 reauthorization and how badly contested, how hotly contested that really was. And so this reauthorization is likely to go through. It's a fairly popular piece of legislation. It doesn't make tremendous changes, but it does make some really important changes that are in line with some of the things that I've been talking about.
And what would those look like?
So there are three provisions in VAWA 2018 that I'm particularly excited about. For the first time, the Violence Against Women Act puts money into alternative justice mechanisms like restorative justice. Restorative justice is really about harm rather than crime. It uses the language of harm, and it asks three questions. What was the harm? How did it affect the person who was harmed? And what does the offender need to do to make it right? And there are a number of different processes that are used to bring that theory into action, everything from victim-offender dialogue to sentencing circles, and they provide opportunities to say to people, you've done harm, you need to acknowledge that harm, and you need to tell us how you're going to be held accountable for that harm. The second is increased protections for people in federally subsidized public housing that keep them from being evicted if they are victimized in their own homes and allow them some flexibility in looking for new housing if that housing is no longer safe. And the third has to do with guns. The Violence Against Women Act has been groundbreaking in terms of getting guns out of the hands of perpetrators of violence. What the VAWA 2018 reauthorization does is close some additional loopholes that will make it easier for law enforcement to take guns from those who have committed intimate partner violence.
Lee Goodmark is the director of the Gender Violence Clinic at the University of Maryland Carey School of Law and the author of the new book, Decriminalizing Domestic Violence, A Balanced Policy Approach to Intimate Partner Violence. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
And that's our show for today. And just a reminder that all this week we're talking about our voting systems, what works, what doesn't, and what's vulnerable. So we'd love to know, when was the last time you voted? Was it easy or hard? When did you go? Did you wait in line? What kind of ballot did you use? Did you think the election was well run? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE and we might play your answer on the show this week. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega and this is The Takeaway.
We want you to be part of The Takeaway's Listener Response Network. We'll send you a few text messages a week about topics we're discussing on our show. To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Again, text START to 69866 to join our conversation every day. You can also connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now on Instagram. We're at The Takeaway.